Let me drop. Was that we had some extremely smart software and firmware writing people on the B-1 bomber program at Airborne Instruments Laboratory, starting in 1975 and ending around 1995. During that period of time, we had some very smart programmers who had a little bit too much arrogance, where the receiver, the main general countermeasures protection receiver, would occasionally have spurious responses. Strong signals would make it do funny things. Close-in signals would make it do funny things. And for years on end, we heard those people saying, don't worry about it. Don't have to fix it in hardware. We'll fix it in software. That was the philosophy. What we rapidly discovered is that once you get spurious signals walking down the IF strip of your receiver, and you think by digital signal processing, you're going to figure out what the hell really happened up front before the distortion occurred. Occasionally, you can hit pay dirt on that. A high percentage of the time, you cannot. Once you get undesirable signals walking into your IF strip, you're in a heap of trouble in the real countermeasures world, electronic warfare world. You better make sure that only the real signals go down that IF strip. In order to make sure that nothing but the real signal at the right frequency region goes down that IF strip, the beginning of that IF strip better have a nice, sharp filter. You better have high dynamic range and good band space tuning in the RF amplifiers. You better have a high dynamic range mixer. But right after that mixer, that very first filter is damn important. That's where I think the so-called roofing filter was originally designed. Other people have added other things to it, is my guess. KC2WGB, K2IW, the TechNet.
KC2WGB, well, it's no wonder he found a little difficulty in getting a good definition. But thanks for that, Glenn. That's a good read out of there. And I'm getting the same information on the Echolink information here. Okay, let me see. Well, you know, Dick, it's amazing that we always know the engineers want to improve the signal upline as far as possible so they don't have to deal with it. It's like you put your preamp at the antenna, not down at the radio. So it's sort of simple stuff, but yeah, they do take shortcuts. Let me let Drop go into one more question and we'll go over to Paul because I'm sure he's got a lot. All right, Dick, got a question here about a Faraday cage. All right, he's dealing at 650 megahertz, 30 milliwatts. He has a self-contained transmitter and a self-contained receiver. Now, he's capable of building a Faraday cage with 70 dB of attenuation. His question is, if he builds two of them, puts that self-contained transmitter in one, the receiver in the other, will that give him 140 dB of isolation or attenuation?
Maybe not. Let's just talk about one Faraday cage itself. If I started off with good copper clad board, copper sheeting, whatever, and I design a six-sided box, a cube, and I solder all of those edges together just right, and by some magic I try to measure the amount of shielding between the outside world and what's going on inside of that copper box, if I've done a good job, I can probably approach 120 decibels of shielding on that thing that I call Faraday shield, anechoic chamber. You can give it a lot of names. You do a real good job, you can get 120 decibels in one layer. There's a catch, a huge catch. Okay, you got your great piece of electronics inside this box. If you're inside that box with your electronics and it's running on a battery, you're probably in pretty good shape. That's not the real world. In the real world, you've got an antenna that's got to go through that shielding and couple the signal into the receiver that's inside of the box. You've got a bunch of leads that have to go through the box to bring the power supply voltages, your plus 15, your plus 12 volts, your minus 5. That's got to be brought into the box with feed-through capacitors. You got some knobs on the front end of the box so you can control things inside to decide what frequency you're going to. You got a internet cable that goes into the box by which you can command your software-defined radio inside. final, out of that radio comes the audio output leads that go to the loudspeaker or to the earphone jack and things like that. As you can see, you can have the world's best bulletproof box, but you have to drill a bunch of holes in that box to bring in the signal, to bring in the repeater.
Time out.
Okay, we still have an Eastern repeater. You have to drill a whole bunch of holes in the box to bring in the power supply voltages, the RF input voltages, maybe the sample for the IF voltage, the audio output. You're building a bunch of holes in the box. That's where the majority of the leakage takes place. If you've done a real good job of using the right kind of filtering on all of those penetrating wires to your beautiful box, you might get 60 or 70 dB of shielding. And as such, in some cases, you build another box around the first box because the individual feed-through devices, there's a limit to the number of decibels of shielding they can give, the B-plus wiring and so on, and the audio output wiring. So you might have to build another box around the first box. So to get really good shielding on just one single thing, you want a bulletproof receiver in the box. You want it to receive nothing but the signal that comes down that antenna cable, and you want it to ignore everything else. There's a whole art and science to building the box with the feed-through leads. That's where the problem really comes in. Let me drop. I did an experiment one day in which I said, let's take the worst case. I've got a box that I know is around 120 dB of shielding. I drilled one small hole in that box, and I put one piece of wire from the outside world into that box. The piece of wire on the outside world had a few inches of length. It went through this very tiny hole, insulated piece of wire, and just barely went inside the box. What happened from that one single penetration with no filtering of that wire going into the box? The box that started off with 110 approximately dB of shielding, in other words, the signal inside the box before you add the wire was 110 decibels weaker. You add that wire, the signal inside the box was not 110 dB attenuated. It had 3 dB of gain to it because of that piece of wire acting as an antenna, bringing signal from the outside world into the box. So the real Achilles heel of shielding is not necessarily the shielding, although there is one of the catches to this one. Let me drop it. In my last consulting assignment, there are a number of very smart computer scientists designing a circuit in which they wanted it to be shielded from the outside world. And they built the most beautiful looking five-sided box. They left the sixth side of the box open because that was the printed circuit board. And they didn't think that one counted a whole lot. And they thought they had a well-shielded circuit. They thought they had 70 dB of shielding. They had about 10 dB of shielding because the sixth side of the box toward the printed circuit board was opened. So you better shield all six sides, and you got to really look twice and three times at every single wire or cable that you bring from the outside world into that shielded box. That's where the grief is coming from 98% of the time. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2QIQ.
Okay, go ahead, Glenn.
You're right on, Dick, about any hole that gets drilled into the box. Like you're saying, getting that first 70 dB is almost low-hanging fruit if all sides are closed. But things I've done in troubleshooting EMI and making really tight EMI shielding was to basically any purged hole would go to, like, if I had to bring AC power into that box, I would take something like another filter for the AC power to enter that was bolted directly to the box. So in other words, the feed-through of the filter was butted right against the box enclosure where my device under test was inside. So if I wanted to bring an AC power, I would basically bulkhead the Schaffner filter, which is like a six-sided device, right up against the box to let those two power leads in. And if I had to get an antenna wire in and out, I would put an antenna on an SO239 or a Type N connector on the side, and then basically build a six-sided filter, passband filter with a six-sided box around it before the antenna wire would go out. So this way, you really were covering all the eyes and nose, all the ins and outs coming in and out of that box, had to go through some kind of filter arrangement to keep all the stray signals out. But that's been my general experience, Dick. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
In the case of the B-1B bomber program that I worked on for something like 20 years, it has a whole bunch of individual replaceable assemblies. They're called LRUs, line replaceable units. The average line replaceable unit was a box that looks a little bit like something you would mount in your rack panel. It's 18 inches wide, maybe 6 inches high, maybe 20 inches deep, and it's got handles on the front cover, and it weighs 60 pounds. Each one of these line replaceable units, and there was 105 of them on the B-1 bomber, all had a input connector that was called the dirty box. In other words, all the wiring from the outside world, your 400 cycle, 220 volt power wiring, for instance, went through a separate box that hung on the back of these line replaceable units. It looked like a doghouse on the bulging out of the back of the box, and all the wiring went through the so-called dirty box. And the dirty box contained a number of cascaded filters, series-mounted filters, multiple stages of filtering to filter all of that wiring before it was allowed to enter the real inside box, which was the six-sided shielded assembly of the line replaceable unit. So there's a whole art and science to bringing outside wiring into a box to try to control what's going in there that you don't want to go in there. And, the worst example I know of, let me drop it. Is way back in 1975 or so, the commercial arm of Airborne Instruments Laboratory was designing a high-power cavity oscillator that ran a couple of hundred watts of output, and it went from a very low frequency, I guess around 100 megacycles, up to a couple of gigahertz. And so to test it, you would like to put a real good multi-hundred-watt dummy load on it to test its characteristics. They didn't have the dummy load. But they had a series of broadband waveguide type feed horns. And by aiming the signal straight up in the air, it presented a pretty good load to test the oscillator. Well, then somebody started saying, gee, as you sweep this thing in high power frequency, even though the feed horn is aimed up in the air, you're reading a lot of signals and jamming other services. So somebody says, okay, we'll put the feed horn inside of a screen room. Oh boy, you don't want to be in that screen room with a high power oscillator. So they put their horn inside the screen room by drilling a hole in the wall of the screen room through the double layer of copper screening. They drilled a small hole and fed a piece of RG8 or RG214 coaxial cable through it. And the feed horn is inside the screen room and the high power oscillator is on the outside. And they thought that now they've got a good dummy load, high power dummy load. Well, what is the feed horn supposed to do? Radiating a signal into space. The screen room is the world's biggest reflector. It's like the chamber inside your microwave oven. The signal reflects back and eventually goes into the horn and gives you an extremely high standing wave ratio. On top of that, they're violating the shielding characteristics of the screen room by drilling this hole through the two layers of screening to bring that piece of coaxial cable in there. Obviously, the whole thing was a disaster, and various people got chewed out for that whole procedure, for not obeying good physics and violating what you're allowed to do with that vital piece of equipment called the screen room. Over to you, Sean. K2RIW.
I have a comment here.
Yeah, fun at work, Dick. But the question was, both units, the receiver and the transmitter, are self-contained. Nothing is outside of the box. They're battery-operated, of course. And he wanted to know if he could just add the two 70 dB ratings and come up with 140 dB. There would be no holes in the box.
That's a very different case. I guess if you've got a battery-operated receiver in one box, a battery-operated transmitter in the other box, hold on now. How is that transmitter with its antenna in that second box going to be operating under real-world conditions? Isn't there a cable coming out of the transmitter box going to the transmitting antenna, and the transmitter antenna is in the outside world? You put a transmitting antenna inside of a screen room. You think you've got an antenna. You don't. Over to you, John. K2RIW.
Comment.
Okay, well, what he was doing, Dick, he had it outside of the cage. He would put it next to the receiver, which was in a cage, and if he got the gain right, he could still detect signal. And this is only 30 milliwatts, very small, and he's at 650 megahertz. So he wanted to know if that other unit, if he built it exactly the same, would give him the 140 dB. The signaling to the transmitter is done with magnetic reeds. Very clever.
Okay, you're telling me the transmitter is in box number two, but where is the output of that transmitter going? Over to you, John.
To the antenna, which is mounted right on top of the transmitter, but the antenna is inside that cage.
Stop right there. You cannot put an antenna inside of a cage. You do not have an antenna. First of all, it's not radiating to the real world. Second of all, whatever its normal standing wave ratio used to be inside of the cage, the standing wave ratio of the antenna, by definition, just went to infinity. And I'm not kidding. Your reflection coefficient of an antenna inside of the cage, if the antenna is lossless and the cage is lossless, then by definition, your reflected power ratio is unity, 0 dB of reflection coefficient. You can't put an antenna inside of the cage and still call it an antenna. It may look like an antenna to your eye. On the piece of paper where you drew a diagram of it, it may look like an antenna. You put an antenna inside of a Gaussian shield, it is not an antenna. It's a dead short circuit. Over to you, John.
Okay, Dick, then it is a moot question because it's not going to radiate itself. Never mind the cage prevented it. Just because it's in the cage, he's not going to get proper radiation out of it. So, all right, I think that's what he was looking for. I'm not sure. I have no idea what he's doing with this, but put a lot of work into it. Very good. I think Wes wanted to make a comment. Back to you, Dick.
2KW. Yeah, KW recognized. You're after Wes. After I make some comments. Yeah, lots and lots of people fall into the trap of saying, I want to shield my antenna. I want to make sure I'm not jamming other services. So I'm going to put the antenna inside of the screen room. At first, it sounds logical. If you know anything about what an antenna really does, you're violating the limit daylights out of physics. An antenna is only an antenna if it is, under normal circumstances, allowed to radiate its signal out into the air or vacuum. It's got to radiate that signal to be called antenna. You put that thing that tries to radiate, and you built it out of low-loss materials, so it's not getting any, it's not generating any heat because you put RF energy into it. Low-loss materials, a high-efficiency antenna, and you put it inside of a screen room. If your screen room has the quality that you think it does, and all of that signal that came out of your antenna bounced around the walls of that screen room, and eventually it all ended up right back into that antenna. This is very similar. Let me drop it.
It's like the microwave.
Exactly where I was going. It's very similar to what happens to your microwave oven. Your microwave oven has got a 700-watt magnetron tube, which has got a little bit of a probe coming out of it that goes into the chamber of the microwave oven. That is a ground plane antenna. It's a monopole antenna. It's the microwave equivalent of a rubber duck. So the rubber duck antenna is sticking into the upper right-hand corner of your microwave oven, radiating a signal into the microwave oven. The signal is going to bounce around 10 times, 100 times, 1,000 times into the six walls of that microwave oven chamber, very well shielded to protect you, and the only thing in there that's absorptive is the food. The water of the food absorbs the energy. On the first bounce, the 100th bounce, and the 1,000th bounce. It's continuously absorbing. You make the mistake of running your microwave oven with nothing in it. The 700 watts coming out of the magnetron tube reflects a zillion times inside of that chamber, and essentially all of the 700 watts goes back into that little probe on the magnetron tube. The tube is happily generating 700 watts, transmitting it out to its little probe, and all of a sudden, because you've operated... You've operated the microwave oven with no food inside, no absorbing object. 700 watts, by definition, comes reflecting back into that tube. The tube used to have 1,000 watts going into it, 700 watts was output, and it was dissipating 300 watts. Now you've added another 700 watts of reflected power. You're asking the tube to now dissipate the whole 1,000 watts. You do that for any significant length of time, and most likely you're going to be buying a brand new tube for that microwave oven. So you can't build an antenna in a shielded chamber. You may think you can. You're violating the physics somewhere. Your chamber better be lossy. There better be lossy stuff in the chamber, or the antenna better be lossy. If not, if you made the chamber high in quality, the antenna higher in quality, then by definition, you look at, you measure the standing wave ratio on that antenna, and you're going to think it's a dead short circuit when it's in that chamber. N2XJN, KQRIW, go ahead, Wes.
Nick, we're about anechoic chambers, KC2QIQ.
That's right. That's what I have a problem with. See, you didn't specify the size of it. The problem is with, you know, levels of load, non-coincidence, or loads of energy expectation as function of load, non-coincidence, or coincidence. Let me jump.
Even if the chamber is anechoic, I watched $10 million go down the brain drain because somebody did that experiment. Go ahead, Wes.
Okay, I have two brains in here that I could possibly ask for the best answer. When you have an electromagnetic field, you're playing with magnetic component of it and electric component with it. So, my question is, let's say you have a unspecified size of anechoic chamber or degreed room, whatever. What are the changes to the outside world when you're playing with the level of electric field or trying to increase that versus the magnetic field and reverse? Glenn, pick up.
Well, I think, Dick, I know the area that's got me confused about this discussion is I'm sure that there's a saturation component because the way EMI is measured, in other words, when you're looking for things like 70 dB microvolts or lower, in other words, you're looking for very, very low EMI emissions coming out of a device, you're using an antenna inside of an anechoic chamber, and you're measuring, looking for a small signal, and the antenna is matched, so it does have match, but I guess there must be a level at which, like if you were saying putting power into the chamber, then maybe that's where the disconnect is coming in here, that when you're using power and you saturate the chamber to the point that you're going to wind up with a mismatch on the antenna or something of that area where the so much energy is going to be reflected. But I would imagine that low enough signal levels, especially like when measuring EMI with Yagi's and other devices inside of a measurement chamber, you can effectively measure. It's done all the time. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
And we have all fallen into a trap. We think we're discussing a subject. We're discussing two very different subjects simultaneously. The original question is the guy is building a shielded chamber, a copper box, around his transmitter and his receiver. And for a zillion years, the electromagnetic compatibility people would make all the measurements in a screen room. Big error. They did it for 30 or 40 years. Screen room measurements. Highly reflective environment. And they tried to measure external fields coming out of a piece of electronics. If they were enthusiastic enough to run the experiment two or three times by taking the device on the test, move it 1 foot to the left, 1 foot up, and 1 foot back, and repeat the measurements so that now the echoes in that screen room come out in phase and out of phase in a different manner into your measurement instrumentation, you could get measurements that changed by 20 decibels. 100-to-1 ratio of change in the measurement because you're making the dumb measurement in a reflective chamber. Most recently, the EMI people have suddenly got very smart and said, whoa, why the hell are we doing? We're doing it in a screened room and a shielded room to shield us from the signals in the outside world. That's the first step. Let me drop. But any conducted or radiated emissions from the device on the test that's in this shielded room is now going to be bouncing off all of those thoroughly reflective metallic walls that are giving you all the shielding. And now, depending on where you put up your instrumentation, it's like me moving my handy talkie around in my bathroom. I can move it left and right, up and down, hold it horizontal and vertical, and the signal I'm listening from this very repeater goes up and down by 30 decibels, 1,000 to 1 in signal strength, just because I've moved the room, moved the antenna around a little bit in that reflective environment of my bathroom. The EMI people have suddenly gotten smart, and they realize that the chamber better have an outer metallic shield that shields them from the outside world, plus anechoic absorbing materials on the walls and ceiling and floor of that chamber. You want to measure the directly radiated signal coming out of the signal under the device on the test, not the signal that's been reflected 5 times off the wall in phase or out of phase, if you know what I mean. So they're now getting smart and making all the measurements in an anechoic chamber, a shielded absorbing chamber, very important. However, that in itself is not a complete solution when you're testing transmitters. I watched. Well, I didn't watch the very beginning of the experiment. I would have been screaming and howling and jumping up and down. A man who should remain nameless, one of the managers of the company I was working for, was testing a very high-powered Navy jamming pod transmitter, a thing that had X number of kilowatts of power output capability. And he was testing it in an anechoic chamber. That's reasonably good, but he needed something to support the thing. The normal device that supports this jamming pod that normally hangs on the pylon below the wing of an EA-6B airplane, that support structure wasn't available. He's in a hurry, wanted to do the test. He found this chunk of foam sitting off to one side. He said, well, we'll sit the whole thing on top of that chunk of foam. The chunk of foam was walk-on RAM, walk-on radio-absorbing material. So inside of it, it had these pyramids of absorbing material with a layer of strong polystyrene on the top. And he radiated the number of watts into that thing. It developed a tremendous amount of heat. It had no way of dissipating the heat. The great big chunk of foam the transmitter was sitting on caught on fire. The bottom line is this whole darn 100-foot-long, $10 million chamber burned to the ground. And the rest of us watched that fire. We watched the firemen try to put out that fire. So when you're putting a transmitting antenna inside of a absorbing chamber, you better be a little bit careful of how many watts, what's the specific absorption rate that your anechoic material is absorbing, is about to be inflicted onto it. Can it tolerate that without going to some ridiculously high temperature, giving you a fire that's going to give you a hell of a lot of trouble? I know you had some more comments on this one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
No, Dick, I think you explained it perfectly. You got right to the point. But in other words, in every chamber, whether you're going to build a Faraday cage or whatever else, it's not a perfect thing. Like we were saying initially, like it's a 70 dB chamber or, you know, of attenuation. And then, of course, there's always something inside the chamber that absorbs a certain amount. So for, you know, microvolt and maybe even millivolt signals inside that chamber, an antenna can tolerate that, and you can observe it. But like you're saying, when you go start putting power inside that chamber, it's got no place to go. I think you did a very nice job of explaining that thing. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
Could you say a few words about changing the ratio of the electrical field and magnetic field in the electromagnetic signal and the effects in on a connection to it?
If I go to the Emerson Cumming material and I buy pyramids of absorbing material, or if I buy the multi-layered flat materials, AN75 for instance, AN79 is a particular product number that's got 5 layers to it of various resistivities to act as a what's the word for it now? It's anechoic material, yes, but it's got a particular taper. Gaussian taper is not the right word for it, but it's close. It's got a taper of impedance versus distance. So the signal goes in, and each individual layer is a very minor change in impedance compared to the layer before it, including the air on the outside, and the signal gets slowly absorbed and not reflected. Okay? Those anechoic materials take that electromagnetic wave, which by all the theory we are being given, which I'm challenging, but I won't go there right now, the electromagnetic wave has a certain ratio of E field to H field, which is related to what we call the impedance of space, 377 ohms. In other words, free space, air, vacuum, acts like a 377 ohm volumetric resistive material as far as an electromagnetic wave is concerned. Once you know the amount of E field that your transmitter has generated, let me drop. You know the amount of E field that transmitter has generated. You know that it's in a 377 ohm air or vacuum environment. You know, therefore, the exact ratio between the E field and the H field. You know that the orientation is one versus the other is 90 degrees apart in space, 0 degrees apart in temporal characteristics, and because of the impedance of space is 377 ohms, you tell me how strong that E field is. At that exact instant, at the exact point, I can tell you exactly how strong is the H field, and vice versa. You tell me how strong the H field is. If it's a free space wave, then I can tell you exactly how strong the E field is if it is a true far field free space wave. It's been radiated from an antenna that is more than the near field distance away from you, 2D squared over lambda. The antenna is far enough away that you're not getting local antenna near field effects. So you're out in the, you're far enough away from the antenna and you're making a measurement. I don't care if you measure the E field or the H field. Either one tells you exactly how strong that signal is because the ratio between those two is fixed by the physics of the so-called impedance of free space. Let me drop. So you're in the far field of this antenna, you're measuring the signal strength, and as I said, you can use instrumentation that measures E, you can use instrumentation that measures H, you can use instrumentation that measures power flux density, milliwatts per square centimeter. You can there's a zillion ways you can measure it, but the ratio is completely fixed in free space. You now take your instrumentation and you start walking toward that antenna. At first, it will obey the inverse square law. Every time you half the distance between you and the emitting surface, you'll get four times as much power flux density. Twice the voltage, twice the E field, four times the amount of power. Every time you double, you half the distance between you and the emitting surface. That works great up until you get to the so-called near field range. You've left the Fraunhofer region, and you're now in the Fresnel region, as it's called, of that antenna. Let me drop. And now, depending on the design of the antenna, whether it be a horn, a loop, a dipole, a Yagi, or whatever, they've all got their own funny near field characteristics. As you start getting close to the antenna, all of a sudden, that ratio between E and H goes out the window. The E can start climbing much faster than you think, and or the H can start climbing much faster than you think. The local circulating energy, and bear in mind that that very simplest of all antennas, the dipole, you've got the 70-ohm transmission line feeding your 70-ohm dipole, and it's steady state, and everything is exactly impedance matched. You know that your signal going down the transmission line, it's a 72-watt transmitter. You know it's exactly 72 volts at 1 ampere going down that 72-ohm twin lead going to your antenna. You know the signal in the steady state is going to go down to the antenna. None of it's going to come back. That's the good news. All of a sudden, you go around the corner from the twin lead, and you start entering the wire of the dipole itself. It's an extremely reflective environment. It's a high Q environment. It is It's a standing wave structure. The signal is going to bounce back and forth on that dipole 10 or more times before it finally gets radiated. The local magnetic field near the wire of the dipole is 10 times higher than you calculate. Near the tip of the dipole, the voltage there is 10 times higher than you calculate. The twin lead feeding the antenna from the 72-watt transmitter. Let me drop. That had exactly 72 volts at exactly 1 ampere. In the wire of the dipole, you have not 1 ampere, but you've got 10 amperes. On the tips of the dipole, you don't have 72 volts, you have 720 volts because of the Q of that standing wave structure. You make near-field measurements near that dipole and try to relate it to free space. At first, it'll drive you crazy. So, the relationship between E and H is fixed if and only if you're talking about a quasi-planar wave in the far field of an antenna. Near the antenna, a whole lot of other things start happening, you better be careful. Maybe that's part of the answer you're looking for, Wes. Sorry, I say it with so much emotion. N2SJN, K2RAW.
Yeah, the last thing that I would like to do is compliment you. But, whoa. That was magnificent. That was beautiful. That was one of the best answers I was expecting. Thank you very much for that.
One other thing I've got to bring to your attention, Wes. You've heard me say that whenever you radiate a signal, it's going to bounce off everything in your environment, even though you don't think so. You think the signal is going to go directly from point A, your transmitting antenna, over to point B, your receiving antenna. It's going to bounce off of everything. You can't stop it from doing that. It's always going to do that. And there's always going to be multi-path propagation. Multi-path, P-A-T-H. I can tell by the email you issued recently, you thought I'm talking about multi-pactor. That's an entirely different phenomenon. Multi-pactor only takes place in the vacuum of space. It was first detected on the Mercury space capsules, where those antennas started behaving very differently because of multi-pactor. Very different from multi-propagation, or multi, what's the word I've used before, you know what I mean? So, signals bounce off of everything. And so, multi-pactor is only something that happens in space, in free space, in a vacuum of space. You essentially never get multi-pactor where air is involved. Any of those electrons that boil off of an antenna because of a multi-pactor effect in space down on Earth, the first thing those electrons are going to do is they're going to ram into a couple of air molecules and they stop moving. There ain't no multi-pactor when you've got air. I wonder if that makes a little more sense, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Thank you very much. You've read my email. Remember we had this discussion when I had the problem with that tree. Actually, Roy has the same one because he doesn't have a tree, but from time to time he has a very bad reception. I mean, the signal level is okay, but it's hard to understand. And I have it usually at this time of the year a few times. And then you explained to us, and you used multi-factor effect. I understand it's not the multi-factor, it's just an effect. So if you could give you word in this area, and to explain.
Now, multi-path is not multi-factor. We all are continuously being exposed to multi-path propagation. Every signal you've ever emitted from every antenna bounces off of every metallic and non-metallic object. It bounces off every single object in your environment. It takes a million paths to get from point A to point B. I don't care if those two paths are 10 feet apart or 10 miles apart. It's taking a million paths to get there. And each individual path has a certain voltage at a certain phase angle. That really means it's a kind of a vector. And at the receiving antenna, you simply add up all of those vectors in a simple voltage summing requirement in the vector manner. You're adding the voltages with their phase angle. That's what the receiver finally receives. And that gives you a little bit of an explanation why that's handy-talky in my bathroom. Let me drop.
Okay, KW.
We're going to go to KW and then Glenn in that order. Handy-talky in my bathroom, where some of the signal is reflecting off my sink, off my tub, off my shower, off the Romex and BX wiring in the ceiling of my house, off the plumbing under the floor of my bathroom. The signal is reflecting off of all of them. It's reflecting off the tower in the backyard. And so there are certain key positions of that handy-talky with its rubber duck in my bathroom where I receive this repeater very well or receive this repeater very poorly. And even though this is a purely vertically polarized repeater, I get the best reception when I put my handy-talky horizontally polarized laying on top of a plastic shelf in my bathroom, that I can hear this repeater the best. That's multi-path characteristics. And all radio signals do that. AW, go right ahead, sir. K2RIW. In fact, it's Alan. Go ahead, Alan.
This is N2KW. Are we still on Faraday cages? Because, we went to huge antennas and multi-paths. And are we still on Faraday cages?
asking the question, is this group of people, with all of their passion and enthusiasm when they get together, are they thoroughly organized and structured, and do they stick to the subject? Absolutely not. When the spirit moves us, and we get onto a particular hobby horse, a particular subject, we go with it. And so, if you wanted a really well-structured net meeting of people, maybe this is not the right one. So we've been hopping all over the place. We're teaching each other how antennas work, how RF work, how shielding works. It's all kind of related, if you know what I mean. Glenn, KC2QIQ, K2RZ, we go ahead, Glenn.
One thing before, Dick, you gave a beautiful dissertation on how the antenna works when you're transmitting. In which you're putting power into the antenna, the currents and the voltages are peaked and maximized, and there's a certain field in the near field of the antenna, and how quite a bit different it is before it starts reaching inverse square law at reaching far field as you start moving away from the antenna. But if you follow the rules of reciprocity and you think about how reciprocity works, and now you want to look at the antenna as a receiving item, what happens in the near field during reception? In other words, if I were just to take an antenna and terminate the feed line with a 50-ohm resistor and we're going to try to analyze what's going on and to obey the laws of reciprocity, what's really happening in the near field? That's not so easy for me to envision. Maybe you've got a little bit more insight. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
As I see it, Glenn, there are many ways of looking at reciprocity. All reasonable passive antennas that don't contain circulators and amplifiers and active devices, all passive antennas, with almost no exception, obey reciprocity. Whatever characteristic you measure when you're transmitting, that could be gain, field strength, front-to-back ratio, front-to-side ratio, side lobe levels, polarization characteristics, ellipticity. There's a zillion things you can measure on that transmitting antenna. You now use that exact same antenna in that exact same environment as a receiving device. It'll have the exact same forward gain, the exact same front-to-back ratio, the exact same standing wave ratio, the exact same side lobe levels, the exact same polarization characteristics, ellipticity ratios. It'll do the exact same thing. Now, let's assume that I'm foolish enough. Well, foolish is not the right word. In the old days, if you made a measurement of an antenna and your instrumentation was mounted too close to the antenna, you got answers that were very difficult to interpret. You're in the reactive near field or the near field of the antenna. There's three regions of an antenna, by the way. Let me drop. Super close to the antenna, quite often inches away or less, you have what's called the reactive near field. The local inductance, magnetics, and the bouncing signals within the antenna or whatever give you all kinds of weird characteristics up close. That's the reactive near field. A little bit further away from that, you have the near field where it still doesn't obey inverse square law. Beyond that, you've got the far field where now you can make real measurements. However, if you're smart enough, if you understand the way radio works, you can make measurements in the near field. You have to interpret them differently. You have to sum them together because you're doing a kind of a holography experiment. You're building radio hologram when you're real close to that antenna. You get different amounts of gain, different amounts of front-to-back ratio, different amounts of side lobe levels. Everything behaves differently. But if you're smart enough and you know the way that signal is going to eventually straighten out that signal, and eventually it's going to straighten up and fly right when it goes out there into space, and if you understand some of the process by which it does that magic, you can make near-field measurements, and you can relate them in a way that's traceable to the Bureau of Standards. Let me drop it.
To get pulled.
I know. So now, to answer Glenn's direct question, I've now mounted my instrumentation inside of the near field of the antenna. I've gotten a reading for apparent signal strength that's too strong, but I've made a measurement. I found out that I put 1 watt into the antenna, and at this particular point in space, my receiving device is seeing 1 milliwatt per square centimeter. And that represents a certain number, and that example I represents a 30 dB of difference in signal strength. 1 watt is plus 30 dBm, 1 milliwatt I received is 30 dB weaker. If I now reverse the process, instead of transmitting with the antenna and receiving with the instrumentation that's too close, I now transmit from the instrumentation that's too close, and I receive with the antenna. It will, again, obey reciprocity, even in the near field. I radiate 1 watt from the instrumentation into the antenna of the test, and I'll see a 30 dB loss. I'll see a 1 milliwatt signal, 0 dBm signal. So reciprocity, even in the near field, works both ways. Is that some of the question I think you were asking, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
It sure is, Dick, but think about this one, though. I guess just to take it a little step further, in other words, obviously reciprocity isn't works in the antennas, but what I'm saying is that, okay, so if we know that there's a ratio, that the voltage is building, and then the amplitudes are decreasing at a very rapid rate until it gets out to infrasquare law in the far field, it has to be doing something similar in the opposite direction for receive to meet reciprocity, which is kind of hard to put your finger on, if you know what I'm saying. In other words, that even though the signal's coming in very, very small, it's got to be getting dramatically smaller as it reaches the antenna. If you kind of follow what I'm saying, the field has got to be like flipped upside down in terms of amplitude, if you know what I'm saying. So in other words, the antenna's really looking at extremely small signals by the time it gets to the antenna. In other words, because the antenna would have to be absorbing that. So it's almost like where everything is maximized at the antenna during transmit, it's got to be seriously minimized during reception, especially if you set like a 50 ohm termination on the feed line as that signal's approaching that that reception antenna. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I think I know where you are on this one, Glenn, and I've been there not too many years ago. I've worked up a mental model that works for me. It's going to sound like it's a little bit off subject at first. Let's go back to that dipole, where I put exactly 72 watts into the 72 ohm twin lead, feeding the dipole. It's exactly a half wavelength long. It's got exactly a 72 ohm resistive impedance. That transmitter is supplying to that transmission line, 72 volts at exactly 1 ampere. On the antenna itself, near the center of the dipole, I measure the current on the dipole wire, which, by the way, is the exact same wire as the twin lead. It just went 90 degrees around the corner, so to speak, to go from the transmission twin lead over to the dipole. How can the exact same piece of wire have 1 ampere flowing in the area where I call a transmission line and 10 amperes flowing in the area that I call a dipole? That's a violation of Kirchhoff's law. Absolutely. Kirchhoff's law only is obeyed if and only if there is no local magnetic field, particularly a non-conservative magnetic field. This is a non-conservative magnetic field. The current of 10 amperes flowing on the dipole, in my example, represents the current flow is the direction of my thumb, parallel to the wire. My fingers wrapping around the wire show you where the magnetic field is flowing around that wire. Let me drop. That magnetic field on the wire of 10 amperes of current, all of those lines of magnetic field are at right angles to the twin lead transmission line. Do not couple to it. It's a non-conservative local magnetic field that allows you to violate the living daylights out of Kirchhoff's law. Only Faraday's law will work in that case. Walter Lewin, in that beautiful experiment in one of his lectures, makes this a hell of a lot more clear. So it is perfectly legal for me to have on the exact same piece of copper wire that made a right angle bend over to the dipole, 10 amperes is flowing on that exact same piece of wire in the dipole, but only 1 ampere is flowing in the transmission line that fed it. Because the signal is bouncing back and forth 10 times, the signal is resonant, it gives you a 10 to 1 increase in current, it's got a Q of roughly 10 in my example, so you're getting a buildup of voltage by 10 to 1, 720 volts at the tips of the dipole, a buildup of current, 10 amperes is flowing instead of 1 ampere near the center of the dipole. Okay, that's what happens on transmit. There's a 10 to 1 ratio of what you think is the power and voltage you've supplied that appears on the dipole when you're transmitting. Now you're about to ask, what happens when you receive? Let me drop. Because I'm receiving that exact same signal into this resonant structure that I call dipole, I know how far away the transmitter was. I know how many watts it was radiating. Therefore, I know exactly what the local E field of that signal coming into my dipole is. I know the E field and the H field by the 377 ohms impedance space. I know what the local E field was before it hit my dipole. Now that signal hits my dipole. And that E field has been coming, electromagnetic wave has been coming from free space for a long time. This is a steady state experiment. I know the volts per meter that was coming into my dipole. And now I measure the volts per meter that are on my dipole. It will be 10 times higher. Say, what the hell's going on here? Where did the multiplication come from? I know the E field coming in volts per meter, and the volts per meter on my dipole is 10 times higher. That's the magic of resonance. It's a little bit similar to you're using your finger and you're pushing on your child that's on the swing. And as long as you do it in phase with the right phase angle, and you do it for a long enough period of time, a very gentle push with your finger, as long as it's an efficient swing with a good set of bearings at the top, you pretty soon build up a very large deflection of your child on that swing. That's exactly what happens when that electromagnetic wave comes into your dipole. Let me drop. Because of the magic of resonance, because you've done it for a long period of time, because it's a very gentle signal coming in from free space, hitting your resonant dipole, it's giving it that very gentle push exactly in phase on every cycle, and pretty soon your dipole builds up a signal that is 10 times bigger in volts, 10 times bigger in current on the resonant dipole. And then a significant amount of that power goes down the transmission line, and it pegs the signal strength meter on your receiver. Now you know a little bit about why that power line from Loco or Power or Con Ed that's across the street from you at the exact same altitude as your dipole, directly in line with the guy you want to talk to in London, how in the world that wire of the Con Ed wiring casting a shadow on your antenna casts almost no shadow at all. It does almost nothing because it is non-resonant. The Con Ed wire doesn't resonate on that frequency of your dipole. That little bit of weak signal that gets shadowed a little bit by the Con Ed wiring, most of it passes through the Con Ed wiring, doesn't react to it because the Con Ed wiring is not resonant. And it comes into the vicinity of your dipole, and after a period of time, it builds up a nice big voltage on your dipole by doing in-phase pushing on each individual cycle. So reciprocity, this crazy characteristic of big voltage and big current on transmit, you happen to get also a big voltage and big current on reception. We're talking about microvolt signals here, but if it's not enough to measure those signals, it is doing that voltage magnification because of resonance. That's the magic of resonance. Let me drop. As such, as you as a good antenna designer, if you're designing an antenna, your highest priority is you will resonate that antenna. You resonate first, then you can radiate. Playing it backwards, you resonate first, then you can receive. I wonder if you've ever heard it expressed this way before, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, absolutely. But I guess here's the conundrum, Dick. The model that I gave you is kind of a tricky one. I said, let's put a 50-ohm resistor, not a receiver, on the other end, and then look at the antennas, because now you really don't have a high Q resonance on that antenna during a reception. So is the antenna even really receiving anything when you put just a 50-ohm resistor on the other? In other words, what signal level is truly just on a 50-ohm resistor on an antenna hanging in the breeze? It's observing something, but what exactly is that at that point? Now, I mean, granted, now, if I put a receiver on the other end that's got a mixer, and I pre-tune a network or an LC coil on the other end to create resonance through the feed point of the antenna, yeah, I can kind of see what you're saying. But if it's just a resistor over there, is it really true? I'm not so sure. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
There's a chance I can make you feel more comfortable on this one. I had a 72-ohm output impedance ideal transmitter, better than one you and I can buy. It really has a real impedance of 72 ohms. It's a balanced transmitter feeding 72-ohm twin lead, feeding my dipole. I'm putting exactly 72 watts onto that transmission line, 72 volts at 1 ampere. On the dipole itself, there's 10 amperes at 720 volts. that dipole, is that it's got that beautiful resonance on transmission. It's got a Q of 10. It's building up everything by 10 to 1 in voltage and current and stored energy per cycle versus dissipated energy per cycle, phase shifts versus frequency, and also, what's the word I'm looking for now? Rate of change of phase versus frequency. All of the characteristics of Q, there's five characteristics of Q, when transmitting the dipole has a Q of 10 in my example. When it's connected to a 50-ohm resistor called transmitter. That transmitter, you and I could design a transmitter, particularly if I put a 10 dB pad after it, that has exactly 50 ohms of output impedance. It is a 50-ohm load on that transmission line while we're transmitting. You and I have enough faith in the law of reciprocity. Let me drop it. Now, when I go back to receiving, it's the exact same transmission line with the exact same 50-ohm at the far end. You call it receiver now instead of transmitter. The transmitter, the dipole antenna and the transmission line doesn't know the difference. If the thing at the beginning was called transmitter, it puts a signal on that. It's still a 50-ohm resistor. When you're receiving, the thing on the far end of the transmission line is called receiver, and it's a 50-ohm receiver. It's the exact same amount of loading on the transmission line. It's the exact same amount of loading, resistor 50-ohm loading, on the dipole in both cases. Nothing changed just because you went from transmission to reception. It did. So does that make it a little bit more clear, Glenn? That nothing changed just because you went from transmission to receiving. The fact that you've got a 50-ohm resistor terminating your transmission line when you're receiving, that did not DQ the dipole. The dipole still has a Q of 10. As far as a schematic diagram of where the resistors are that's loading the dipole, whether you're transmitting or receiving, makes no difference. There's still a 50-ohm resistor in the exact same place in both cases.
Efficiency of receiving and efficiency of transmission changes.
KC2QIQ, K2LIW. Go ahead, Glenn.
No, Leslie, it doesn't. Other than the fact of any resistive losses in the feed line or the antenna, if the resistive losses are relatively negligible, then there's no efficiency difference between receive and transmit. But, yeah, no, I see where you're coming from, Dick, and it's reciprocity. It's just that, you know, I try to always envision, okay, the transmit mode where there's, the voltages and currents along the antenna, and you have a maximum at the antenna tip, but, yeah, that ratio still has to be maintained, on receive. So, yeah, it does make a lot more sense. It does help. Thanks, Dick. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
Thank you. We've gone way beyond the time that we should have gone over to Paul, and Paul's got an exciting story to tell us about. I can't think of the name of Solitaire. Not the right name. The spacecraft that went to 67P, the asteroid, did land, had a little bit of difficulty, and did transmit some pictures, and we're getting data out of it. And so give us that story, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
Okay, this is WS2N. Yes, the Rosetta is doing very well, the mothership. It's still in an orbit around that 67P. And you were wondering last week about the orbit, and it's 12 hours, and it's around 14 to 17 miles up. And it released Philae, and it went down to the comet, and it just had springs released. There was no charge or anything. There was no thrusters. This thing just dropped like a slow falling rock all the way down to the surface, and then it so-called landed. Remember last week we talked about harpoons and these big ice screws that were in the feet. Well, the harpoons never went off. There were two of them, and the harpoons were supposed to dig into the comet, and then it was going to pull itself toward to the comet, and then the ice screws were going to come on. Well, they never fired. Now, since they didn't release, these long legs, each leg looked like about a meter long, three legs came down, and they were on springs, you know, some kind of a, you know, the little push.